why isn't that cable? There's a wire in the center of the cable. And there's a whole bunch of wires almost by the jacket, and those are connected to ground. And it's not for the reason that you think. That thing's called the Hochstetler shield, and the purpose of it is to prevent the insulation material inside. It essentially equalizes the stress and prevents corona from happening.
82HUC with a comment.
Steve recognized, but before we go to Steve, Eric, the shielded wiring that you're describing at your broadcast station, done for corona reasons to make sure that it's not creating electromagnetic interference to your broadcast operation, is that three-phase wiring where each individual lead is shielded in the manner in which you describe? That's an amazing setup. I presume that's something that's rather expensive to do, only done at a place of high priority like a broadcast station. My guess is the ordinary transmission lines throughout the county are not all done that way because of the extra cost. That's a guess on my part. KE2EJ, K2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2LIW, K2J, if you've got Google in front of you, look up Hochstetler, that's H-O-C-H-S-T-A-T-T-E-R, shield, okay? It was invented, actually, it was patented by Martin Hochstetler, I think in 1916, and it's in every high voltage line that's above 2K. And what it does is it actually equalizes the, let's call it, equalizes the electrical stress of the insulation itself. It prevents the wire from disintegrating, literally, because of all of that energy that's in the semiconductor of that cable. That's what I'm talking about. And yes, I've got 3 13.5 lines that come into my main transformer, and I have some hunks of that cable, including the cable that we used to have buried underground, down, going down to Washington Avenue to provide power. And I'll show you what happens to that after it burns up. It gets very crispy. K2IW, K2J.
Yeah, that wire is called a distributed stress cone.
I'm reasonably sure that quite a bit of the high voltage transmission lines across Long Island are not shielded in that manner. For two reasons, I can tell they're not, because I will see as many as 17 individual pie-shaped cascaded porcelain insulators that are insulating each of the wires the way they're mounted to the support tower. And there are days when the mist is just right in which I will hear arcing taking place across that wiring. So the individual wires being shielded from the outside world, I think, is not used in many places, is my first impression, Eric. KE2EJ, to correct me on that. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. You may not, you know, you think of a shield as a braid. This is actually individual strands of copper that runs on the outside edge of the cable. And it's used everywhere. I haven't seen a piece of wire that doesn't use it. Seriously, go to Google, look it up, and it'll explain it all for you.
I believe it's seriously not used in Rockaway, because I can see them wires arcing up there.
So can I. Everybody would like to get the beep.
Hi, Zed, with a question.
If the individual wires were shielded in the manner in which you describe, Eric, then the 17 cascaded porcelain pie-shaped insulators would not be required. If the individual wires to the outside world are already shielded, why would you have this huge amount of insulators on many of the 300 kilovolt transmission lines that we see going across Long Island? Something's wrong here. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Is that a question?
With a comment.
Well, all I can tell you, Dick, is I'll show you some samples of real cable, and I'll show you, actually, just go up to any of that LIPA guy and ask him about this, to show you a piece of the 13.5 or the 46 or the 66 KV cable, and you'll be very surprised.
Okay, we've got a comment, and then IZ in that order. A comment, It's probably one of the guys that signed in before. Go right ahead, comment.
All right, KD2HUC. Yeah, Dick, you're both right. The way it works is that when you have open air clearances, you can do exposed wire, you know, bare conductor on porcelains. And that's the way most of the transmission lines are run. When you're going to bring those conductors within arc over clearance of each other, like if you're going to send them down a conduit to go underground or into a transformer vault, now they have to be insulated and rated for full voltage. So, and that's the type of cable that Eric is describing. There are various flavors of it. Eric is discussing, you know, a braided neutral, you know, which is made of copper strand. They have flat strap, and all these different types of cable are based upon the available fault current of the circuit providing it. But that's why most likely Eric has a pad mount transformer, and therefore he would have shielded cable supplying it that comes from a riser pole coming from open air conductors. Both ends of the cable, as John said, have to be terminated with stress cone terminators before they can, you know, be you know, terminated safely. KD2HUC, back to net.
I thank you, Steve. We're slowly getting closer to a kind of a truth here as to what's going on. John's got a question. K2IZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, John. Wait for the beep.
I'm kind of glad that somebody did bring up, you especially, Dick, about the arcing of the wires. Back by 91, they sent me out to school out in Belcourt. That was all the phone companies. And at the time, the plan was to feed every neighborhood with fiber to a pole, and then everything was going to be radio frequency, phones, data, alarms, faxes, you name it. And you know, each area around the pole would be a different band, your A, B, C, D. So this way here, when they spread them all over the place, they could overlock the bands. And my last question to them, and this is back in 91, they never got back to me, was I live on the south shore of Long Island, and we have a little problem here called, you know, salt air, salt water, when it gets, you know, damp and stuff like that. And like you said, sir, sometimes you look on the, up on those poles, and you see arcs sparking. And my question to them was, isn't that a form of spark gap transmitter? And how will that affect this, you know, transmission group? Is that going to cover that part of the spectrum? So if you have a rainy, foggy night and these poles are arcing and sparking away, is that going to cause problems? And of course, one, you know, bright young gentleman from Bell South jumped up and says, lighting company, the power company has to fix those problems, at which point I had to sit down. I was laughing so hard. But Dick, would that sparks you see up on the high tension wires, would that cause a problem for that type of transmission? Over.
Verizon WDM.
Oh, absolutely, John. Back in the days when we had analog television, Channel 2 had more of it, Channel 4 had a little less, Channel 5 had a little less. Of what I'm talking about is that you would see two white snowy bars, horizontal bars across the television set that slowly moved vertically. They slowly moved vertically because the color television signal was 59.9 frames per second and local power arcing over is 60 frames per second. So on the positive half cycle you get an arc, and negative half cycle you would get an arc when the voltage hit peak, and that's what's making those white bars drift across the screen slowly. So with analog television, you could easily see the interference on your screen. Now that we've got digital television, you don't see those bars anymore, but there are times when your digital over-the-air television doesn't work because of that. Let me drop the broadcast companies and the testing that was done in order to qualify digital television. They soon discovered that the channels 2 through 6 are very subjected to local interference of that kind. That's the main reason why almost all of your digital television starts at channel 7 and goes up.
I'm at channel 3.
There is a channel 3, but I'll bet you it has a lot of dropouts for a lot of people who tried to measure it, who tried to watch it over the broadcast. So it certainly does make problems. I'm going to be going over to Barry in a minute to ask him about it. In fact, let me ask Barry right now. Let me drop this. Barry, who lives in Far Rockaway. It's as far south as you can get. He's as close to the Atlantic Ocean as you can get. He gets salt spray like you wouldn't believe. As such, the 300 kilovolt line that runs down Far Rockaway, my guess is there's multiple places where you can drive your automobile with the window open and hear that arcing and sparking. That's a guess on my part, Barry. N2 Moonbound in Far Rockaway. K2RIW, go ahead, Barry.
Now, most definitely, any night of the week, any night of the week, you can walk out in the street and you can see and hear the arcing. No problem at all. Now, you take a damp night, which is, you know, like tonight, it was raining tonight, and it gets even worse. It's terrible. It never goes away, even on a dry day. Sometimes when the temperature is down around, you know, like 10 degrees, it ain't so bad. But it's always, always, always there. They're never going to get rid of it. N2MB.
If you have a real heavy rain, and temporarily those porcelain insulators become washed, and then get a chance to dry out, does the arcing and sparking get a little bit better after a heavy rain before the next salt spray environment comes about, Barry? On top of that, that's question number one. And question number two, because of all that arcing and sparking in your neighborhood, my guess is when you listen to 6 meter and 2 meter ham radio, if you're not using a real good noise blanker, I'll bet you hear a lot of, I bet you your noise level is way above S2 on the single strength meter. Is that true, Barry? N2 Moonbound, K2RIW.
Even as we speak tonight, it's that way. Absolutely. It never goes away. Now, interestingly enough, while it is raining, during a heavy downpour, it's at its best. The static level drops to its lowest point. If it's a foggy night, it gets very bad. If it's raining, though, if it's actually raining, it ain't so bad. Ain't that weird?
Let's see what's actually sparking.
No, it's not so weird, Barry. The salt on those insulators is a very conductive material. By very conductive, I mean, if you had an ohm meter you put across it, you would see many megohms. And that many megohms is not a linear resistor. That high voltage is looking at those individual salt crystals on those porcelain insulators and arcing between them. But on a heavy rain, the salt spray is being washed off those insulators during the heavy rain. If the rain itself doesn't contain a whole lot of mineral matter, and hopefully good rain in our neighborhood, when it comes straight out of the sky, is pretty pure water. So water itself, if it's pure enough, is an extremely good insulator. Very few bodies of water have that low of mineral content. But if you're able to get demineralized water and you measure its resistance with the right kind of instrumentation, you'd be amazed what a high number it is. So that pure rain coming down is a non-conducting material washing away that salt spray. So the fact that you see very little sparking and arcing on a heavy rainy night makes some sense. Even though you and I normally consider water a conductor because of its mineral content, once it has reached the ground or once it's come out of your faucet, now it's got mineral content. Over to you, Barry, N2MB, K2RIW.
I believe Eric will not agree with me. Depends on where he lives. But if you live inland a little bit, you know, like a quarter of a mile or a mile from the ocean, when it rains, the static gets worse. Because it is worse. But where I live, when it rains, that's the good part. You know, it's just so bad in Rockaway. Over to you, Dick, and 2MB.
I said,
Eric was the first guy who wanted to make a comment on all of the above. KE2EJ, K2I, that'd be great, Eric.
No, I'm just really curious to know where the spotting is occurring. Is it occurring from the 13.5 line going to the transformer, or is it occurring across the ceramic of the insulator? The other interesting thing about, when you think about it, is the conductivity on the insulator from the salt. Once it actually makes the connection, it starts to heat up the air ionizes, and that's how you get a nice big spark across it. Now I'm just curious to know where physically it's happening, and is there a possible cure for it? That's all.
There's no cure for it. I've been here my whole life, Eric. Let me tell you. You can see the arcing. You can get out there with a pair of binoculars and watch them arc. They're never going to go away. Never, never, never.
But what I'm asking is, where is it physically happening?
It's physically happening across the... Oh, boy, this thing's making noise. Across the insulators. It's physically happening across the insulators. I can see it.
Believe you. I'm just thinking about a solution, that's all.
You could wash the living daylights out of those insulators, but the salt spray of his environment means they're going to get dirty again in the next 4 days. Over to you on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW, wait for the beeps.
Dick, it could get bad within hours after the rainstorm. If you get a breeze off of the ocean, and you always do after a rainstorm, there's always a breeze off the ocean. That breeze has salt in it. Bingo, it's back on the lines again.
You know, I could think of a couple of solutions to it, but they would be expensive. That's probably why they don't do it.
Tell us what you think is a solution. Because the insulator has got to be there because 13.45 kilovolts is there. Therefore, there's got to be 17 of those porcelain pie-shaped objects. That's the only way you can have the right kind of dielectric strength to not be arcing to the tower. No matter how you wash that away, Eric, his salt spray is going to restore it, I think. KE2EJ, K2IW, wait for the beeps.
This is a problem. A higher frequency. Anything above 1296 is nice and quiet. I've noticed that my whole life.
Yeah, there's an explanation for that, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
No, I'm thinking in terms of my experience of working on marine radars when I was a kid, and also the high voltage transmitters that I have. I could see a really simple but rather expensive solution. You know, using insulated lines, that would mean that the simplicity of making a connection to a transformer would no longer be simple. It would be way more expensive. But essentially, if you have insulated cable, and it goes into the interior of an insulator, whereas usually outside of the insulator is a mechanical mount to hold it in place, the insulated cable goes into the interior of this insulator, and its connection is made in the interior of the insulator, going into, say, the transformer, having a similar type of device where you either have a compression O-ring to keep the outside environment out, or you seal it with some kind of silicone, or, you know, high voltage breakdown silicone type material, where the salt will no longer ever see a piece of metal that has juice on it.
K2HC with a comment.
The kind of insulated and shielded cable that you're describing, Eric, if you're doing an underground installation or an underwater installation, and you're willing to spend all those megabucks per mile, that's a beautiful solution. If you're now stringing that many miles of wiring across a place like Long Island or New York State.
I did say it'd be prohibitively expensive.
Yeah. And you've got this many miles of wiring being waved back and forth in the wind and being fatigued, and you want that all to stay hermetically sealed for the next 50 years. Even if you're willing to spend the money because of the way the ice and cyclic loading of temperature and snow and everything else and mechanical wind flexing, those wires across our high-tension towers would never survive that environment. Even if you're willing to spend the money, that's my first guess on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
K2IW, K2EJ. Somehow I don't agree with that. Just the way K2 cables are run between phone poles. I mean, you notice they're not taut. There's actually a little give because there's motions that occur because of wind and everything else. Yeah, you're going to have breakdown of insulation material. What happens in life, you know, the UV attacks the outer jacket of a piece of cable. You experience that with your collapse. I don't see it as an impossibility. I see it as a really doable path, but what it really means is you're custom designing every piece of length of cable that's going up on a pole into this system, whereas that the mechanical motion is something that can be overcome. And if you anchor things properly, the mechanical stresses that are created just from its own weight become non-existent. So, in that sense of the word, I don't agree with you. I mean, I have my tower with my guys. If my guys were straight like that, the damn thing would be on the ground. KTRIWK, KTRIJ.
I said, question. We're going to go over to Steve. Steve, you're in this business. Wait for the beeps and tell us whether or not these kinds of insulated cables that Eric is describing, I don't think there's enough money in the world to string all the 345 kilovolt lines in that manner.
I didn't say you could.
Across Long Island. Let's see what Steve's got to say about this. KD2HUC, K2LIW, go ahead, Steve.
Hi, KD2HUC. Dick, I see three problems here. One, the triplex cable that Eric is describing, they do it. They do it in certain areas where it's easier, you know, if they have to run lower than regular clearance on utility poles, if they have to reroute a feeder and it's going to be lower than the usual 35 feet or greater, they'll use the insulated cable. The problem with it is that it's extraordinarily heavy, which means now you know, if your poles are not strong enough, you either have to include, you know, shorter spans or you have to go with bigger poles. The next problem is every time you need to tap that cable, you need a stress cone termination because you need to properly terminate the conductor with reference to the shield so that there's no flashover. And three, let me let it drop. You know, when there's a fault on an open air cable, 9 times out of 10 it will blow itself clear unless it's an insulator or a cross arm. You know, if there's debris, mylar balloon, whatever, it'll blow itself, you know, it'll fault, relays will kick in, it will clear the fault, and, you know, the line will be re-energized. If you do it with a cable, if there's an insulation failure or a flashover, that's it. The insulation's destroyed. Cable's gone. So now you have to send somebody out there to cut and terminate a new piece of cable in there in order to get power back. So it's not, I don't see it as a feasibility. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, I know John's got a question, but let me first go back to you, Steve, on this one. What percentage of the Long Island high voltage transmission systems, 345 and 128, I think much of the system throughout Long Island, I think, is qualified for 345 kilovolts, but I think they're using it at 128. What percentage of it is shielded in the way you're describing? What percentage of it's non-shielded? I'm going to guess that 90-some-odd percent of it is non-shielded. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2HUC. Yeah, Dick, actually, more than you would know, you know, than what you would think. Anything that goes underground is shielded cable. It has to be, for obvious reasons. To my knowledge, 335 outside of Connecticut territory does not exist on Long Island with the exception of in Garden City, the Y-49 cable that comes down from Westchester, comes in at 345 into the Garden City stub and they step it down to 138. Other than that, it's only 138 lower across Long Island. A lot of it, you know, like I said, anything that's underground is shielded, you know, full voltage insulated rated cable, and anything that's, you know, above ground is open air insulators. Back to net.
Yeah, there was somebody who told me that much of the wiring on Long Island is qualified for 345. Each of those pie-shaped large porcelain insulators, I think, are good for 20 kilovolts.
In many places, I can count 17 of them cascaded. 17 times 20 would be 340. So that means that the wiring is qualified for 345, but I think it's really running up 138. I think you're saying almost none of the distribution in Long Island is 138, but they have the ability to go to 345 if they need extra power capability, is my guess. And where we're talking about of wind off Long Island shores, we're talking about wind power and solar voltaic, where the total power flowing through that transmission system is going to be later, greater at some day. Does that mean that in some of those cases, with a little bit of a retrofitting, we have the ability to go to 345, John, Steve, KD2HUC, K2RW in the TechNet?
I don't know about the open air circuits, Dick, but as far as I know, the underground cables, they're rated, they don't go up to 345. It's a completely different class of cable. The oil cables, the majority of the oil cable circuits that they have, I don't think they'll go as high as 345. Like I said, you know, as far as I know, Con Ed uses a lot of 345, you know, PSE&G, not so much. The only cable that I know of that's 345, and I'm pretty sure it's owned actually by Con Ed, like I said, is that one cable that comes down from Westchester.
Okay, we've had John standing by quite a long time for a question. K2IZ, K2IZ, go with your question, John.
It looks like it kind of wandered off from my original question, but let me throw this out there, and then, you know whatever you want to do with it. After Sandy, over on Fire Island, the outside plan for the phone company was totally wiped out. They basically told the people, we're going to give you this system that's all wireless. And it didn't do a lot of things that it was supposed to do. The alarm systems didn't work the whole nine yards. Fast forward to heaven forbid if it happens. Long Island gets hit with a major Cat 3, Cat 4 at high tide. All right. Well, the outside plant gets wiped out. Verizon now turns around and says, okay, look, we're not going to replace the outside copper plant. But LIPA or the PSE&G replace their stuff, Cablevision replace their stuff. We are now going to offer this, I guess it's going to be UHF or higher service where there's no lines coming to your house, not even Fios. And this service is going to do all the phones, video, computers, whatever have you. Again, the key thing is they're going to tell us, and I think it's going to happen, you'll hear it, we're not going to replace the outside plant. You're getting wireless whether you like it or not. Back to the question, if you're down in Far Rockaway, they want that, that's the scenario. How would it affect the service? How would it affect the service up by you, Dick, if they told you we're not replacing the outside telephone plant? This is what we're going to, and it's going to be all wireless.
Well, there's two separate things we need here. We need power wiring, and we need a lot of communication wiring. We all would like to have 10 megabits of uplink and downlink capability. That's for phone, emergency, telephone, television, cable TV, the whole works. So in order to get the kind of bandwidth we would desire, we all would desire 10 megabits. We'd like to be able to upload and download a video channel live as opposed to slowly doing it, recording it, and playing it back.
More zeros to that, please.
Okay. I think we could survive with 10. You would like it to be at least 100 is what I think you're saying, Eric. You want at least 100 megabits, and maybe even a kilobit. I mean, a gigabit of uplink and downlink capability. To do that in a wireless manner and guarantee high signal-to-noise ratio across that bandwidth.
5G is all about, and that's why they're selling television stations.
Okay. Do you see a future of, say, a place like Long Island, where 1 gigabit uplink and downlink capability, truly wirelessly to every home without fiber going to the homes, do you think that's really going to take place, Eric? It's not just a pipe dream. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, I don't know if you got the 47 gigahertz band. There's a lot of space there. There's a lot of megahertz to put stuff. Do I see a gigabit in and out of a home? No. Sorry, no, I just don't see that wirelessly. You're even gobbling up all the space upstairs because you got to share it with the people around you. I mean, it's still going to be a cell organization. Whereas as much as that they don't want to do, what they really won't want to do is they don't want to do end-user distribution because, sorry, even the Doge frequency, the cell site's going to have to be pretty somewhat nearby to even get 100 megabits. So, you know, I mean, you look at what you can do with your cell phone and look at how close the towers are stayed. And think about the infrastructure that goes in between them. You know, there's wires there. They're just not connected to you.
We can dream about a system running at 47 gigs or 21 gigs that has enough bandwidth. That's the good news. And if you and I, Eric, are willing to set up a small feed horn at 47 gigs from point A to point B, aimed at each other without a bunch of trees in between, getting that bandwidth is easy. Can you imagine the degree of difficulty of trying to make something close to a gigabit of uplink and downlink capability in a truly wireless manner to each individual home and therefore to each individual cell station? Boy, the words roll off the tongue real easily. But 47 gigs, when it hits the leaves of trees, dies. So what kind of spacing... The so-called micro-cell sites, you'd have to have a cell site every fraction of a mile from every house to do it truly wirelessly in an omnidirectional manner. KE2EJ, K2LIW, am I overly pessimistic here?
In a certain sense, yes, but in another sense, no. I mean, let's be realistic. Jim Taylor, JT65. He picks signals up out of the noise, okay, so what we're really talking about is a form of signal processing. ADSB, COFDM, that takes space, but they work kind of well for what they are at the frequencies at which they operate. And by the way, we use them all the way up in the 14 gig range without issue. But, you know, here we're talking about having an omnidirectional device reaching a bunch of homes, so... Is it worthwhile to them if they can reach 5 homes or 10 homes at one particular microcell? Yeah, it might be worth it because when you look at it over a period of 10 or 20 years and look at the income that you get from it, yeah, it becomes worthwhile. I mean, it's up. So, in that particular sense, it doesn't really matter what frequencies you use as long as it's, you're keeping it in a confined space and you're looking at it economically in terms of it. A small cluster of homes, especially in the beginning when you had cable and you had your Wi-Fi connection or your internet connection, you don't realize it, but you were actually being connected to a small cluster because the data centers could only handle, the routers at that time in the beginning only handled like 100 customers or 200 customers, and that became a sub that connected to a bigger line, which became a sub connected to a bigger one. So, in a certain sense, you would do that on a micro scale of RF. So, yeah, it is possible, but the reality is that the type of signal processing that we do, the way we add Reed Solomon and Trellis and these other things that we do to the RF to help make sure we're getting the right data back. And the forms of compression, which actually, what they're talking about today, I don't like because it doesn't produce the kind of picture I want to see or that you see when you turn the TV on. So, you know, what's tomorrow going to bring? Tomorrow, right? K2RIW, K2J.
I see goods and bads in what you just said to us, Eric. And I'm about to go to an exact example that John is bringing to our attention. Let me first go back a little bit. JT65, Joe Taylor 65, is a beautiful Reed Solomon-like technique with a kind of direct sequence spread spectrum. It's a kind of a spread spectrum technique. The good news is it can take 27 dB below the noise and pick up that signal.
Oh, no argument.
The bad news is that the bit rate of the real data flowing through the system is extremely slow, and we're trying to get 100 megabits or almost a gigabit of data. Now let's go to John's situation. Assume now that you've got, in the summertime, a large number of private homes on Fire Island.
and by way of the wireless techniques that you are now describing, make a rough guess as to how many microcell sites and how much infrastructure would be required to give all those people, let me pick a number, 100 megabits uplink and downlink, to give them 100 megabits per second across all of Fire Island in the summertime when all those homes are occupied. Do you realize what kind of infrastructure would be required to do that? Who the hell is going to pay for that? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, that's the difference between you and a large corporation that's going to be around for the next 100 or 200 years. Payback doesn't have to be instantaneous. And the cable, the way cable came about and became, it proves that too. Because, you know, it in the old days it cost $1,800 to string a mile of cable and amplifiers and all the stuff to pay for the people. Now it's something like $3,000 or $4,000 a mile in our world. You know, the way the value of money as it is now. And cable's been around for, let's see, they started here in like 1970, so that's quite a few years to make their money back. And don't forget, they've got an amplifier servicing maybe 5 homes or 10 homes, and then there's another amplifier servicing another 5 or 10 homes, and those things cost $1,000 or $2,000 a piece. Let me let it drop again. And with the type of FPGAs and VLSIs that we make today, for example, you can make an entire 8VSB transmitter in 3 chips. So that brings the cost of doing all the data processing and all the data reduction, the high-speed stuff that you need to provide 100 megabits up and down. And then if you're doing small cells that are, say, 10 or 15 homes, and your connection, by the way, I have a 100 gigabyte connection over Cat 6 cable between here and New York, which is not so hard to do, whereas at the microcell would essentially have one Cat 6 cable connecting to the next microcell, connecting to the next microcell until it gets to the final terminal unit. So yeah, I see it as something that can be feasible over the long term. You know, the cost of whatever it is that you're making, which would be the modems at the user end or the transmitter, the cost of them is going to come down when you start making them by the hundreds of thousands. K2RIW, K2J.
I've got a different point of view, Eric, and let's see if you knock some holes in this one. 30 years ago, coaxial cable looked awful good, and cable TV systems became quite popular in many communities across the United States. Along came fiber. And when fiber really started exercising all of its capability and was really wrung out in development, you suddenly realize you can get tens of gigabits of information on fiber with very close to 0 dB of loss per mile. As such, you can string a whole lot of data, a whole lot of distance, with very little amplification with fiber.
What is the cost?
Tell me why it would be more expensive, why it would be less expensive with your approach. If I used rugged enough cable and I put a whole lot of fiber on Fire Island to each individual home, convince me that that's not the cheapest way to get a lot of bandwidth in a hurry.
Spend on maintenance.
Yeah, but it's got to be a well-designed system that can tolerate the occasional salt washing over your cable. If you make the cable system rugged enough, and if it's fiber, it's hard for me to believe that putting fiber to every house on Fire Island is not the least expensive, most reliable way compared to trying to do it with this very elaborate wireless system. Over the air, huge bandwidth, with weather and whatever, and the trees and insertion loss, absorption, and weather dropouts, that's going to be hard to justify by comparison to fiber. The only other thing worth considering is satellite. A satellite system to each of the homes or groups of homes in Fire Island, maybe. But I think fiber is something you've got to definitely consider. KE2EJ, K2IW. And
you'll pick up that station in a second. You have out of this. You know what happens on KU or... Oh, you don't have anything on KA. You have no idea what happens when it rains. Of course you do. But, you know, you have that issue with that. But we're talking Microsoft here. I mean, think about it. What did a cell phone look like in 19, when they first came out in 1980? How big was it? How heavy was it? And now look at it. Okay? And how many bands is coming out of that phone of yours? When you start talking about Microsoft and you're limiting the range in which things are operating, you can overcome certain things. I'm not saying that it's going to be at 40 gigahertz. Actually, it might be. The FCC just gave them 3 gigahertz around. They cleared out a military spectrum to give it to the phone company. There was a experiment, and I can't think of the name of it now. It was actually a series of TV transmitters that were on Channel 55 that were being able to be picked up by the smartphone that they were issuing, and that sort of fizzled out. The whole name of the game here is economics. Okay, if you don't have to send a guy out into the field to climb poles in people's backyards, it's a lot easier to send one guy to a transmission center and deal with an issue. And if you have many of these little transmission centers, which essentially could be on a pole, because we're not talking megawatts of output here, you get the idea. It all comes down to how much do things cost in this world that we live in. K2RIWK2EJ.
The cost of those downlink 12 gigahertz, 18-inch diameter dishes, satellite TV, has gotten so inexpensive. Downlink-wise, getting enough bandwidth to each individual home without big bucks, easy. And yes, you get some rain dropout, but the rain dropout is less than an hour total per year. Those customers will tolerate an hour per year of dropout, and even that can be corrected if they're willing to re-steer the dish, because it's not absorption that's creating the dropout. It's cross-polarization of the raindrops when they're big enough, and you only get raindrops that big for very short periods of time per year. So downlink is easy. Uplink on satellite, that's a little bit more troublesome. And so if you compare the cost of that versus zillions of microcell sites across Tri-Realm, let me drop. If Fire Island was a dense, two-dimensional community, microcell sites, you could sell it. It is a linear community. It's got a little bit of width and a whole lot of length. Therefore, you need a big infrastructure of microcell sites to do over-the-air, bi-directional uplink and downlink by a truly RF technique. I don't think that's going to happen. Even no matter how modern your new cell phone-like system is, that's a belief on my part. Someone else wanted to make a comment or question. Who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. This is George again, KD2FIU. For one thing, I have to agree with you that the capability to build incredibly durable fiber optic fiber optic facilities has been around. We have them transatlantic, transpacific. We have them in the oceans all around the world. And of course, I think as K2EJ pointed out, it's the cost of the maintenance. Another thing is that when you're talking about satellite, you do have a certain propagation delay because I got to drop it. Concept behind facilities and networking still contains a massive amount of switching. That switching would mean that you're not always hitting the satellite that's immediately in range and the satellite that's immediately leaving you. If you do, it may have to send it to another satellite 4,000 miles away to drop it back into the network to come over the fiber optic network back to you because of this concept called switching. Switching is very prevalent. It's not just facility oriented. Let me drop.
Talking about a marathon, aren't you?
Come back.
The system you're describing, I believe you're talking about Amerisat?
I'm just talking about if you want to go these ways and go with it with massive capacity, you're going to have propagation delay if you send it up to satellites. Another thing is, food for thought right here, and to bring it into the next step, we had data on our phones. Then we had 2G. Then we had 3G. Then we had 4G. Then we had 4G LTE. All containing more sites, more bandwidth, more frequencies that were granted to be available by the FCC to the phone companies as they proved that they could utilize and deliver the services. However, when we are doing this, keep in mind, it's not dedicated bandwidth. It's also an advancement in switching. 5G. 5G is another, a totally different concept beyond 4G LTE. KD2, FIU.
You bring up an interesting point, George, about the propagation delay. The hugest disadvantage of a satellite telephone system is up and down one time is a third of a second, and then up and down a second time is another third of a second, so that if you and your buddy are both by satellite, geosynchronous satellite, having a phone conversation, the only way you can stop both talking simultaneously and both listening simultaneously is that you have to keep saying over. In other words, I finished that particular sentence, I say over, and with two-thirds of a second delay, I start getting an answer from my buddy if he's a real quick talker. And that's a pain in the neck.
As I, well, we got some tricks.
Well, you can make it sound a little bit better, but still you're going to be talking on top of each other is the problem because of that two-thirds of a second total round-trip time with the person you're talking to. That's one of the reasons why satellite telephone circuits became quite unpopular and fiber landlines, so to speak, or undersea lines became a hell of a lot more proper, a lot more popular. How would you get around that two-thirds of a second total round-trip time between you and the guy you're talking to over that geosynchronous satellite telephone system? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
WS2N.
Well, I don't know if you've ever watched the national news, and they're talking to the guy in London, or they're talking to the guy in Israel, and it's smooth. He says his thing, he says his line, and then the guy in the listen place comes back. Sometimes it pauses a couple of seconds before he responds. Depends how they hook up the circuit. But what we do is we actually delay what you're seeing, and the producers at each end have the cues and know what the delay time is, and they cue the people at the appropriate moment. So, you know, it's a trick. It doesn't really solve the problem, but it's just well-coordinated TV production. And I've got some comments about the other gentleman in terms of switching, and that's TCP/IP, which actually happens now. And don't think that your internet connection is a, you know, a speed of light connection to wherever you're connecting to, because it's not. You know, the whole concept of TCP/IP is to be able to get to wherever you need to go by whatever method possible. K2RIW, K2J.
The time delay on a satellite communication system, synchronous satellite system, in the case of electronic news gathering in remote areas, you can correct that by recording the whole thing, taking out the blink times before you rebroadcast it. That's good for a rebroadcast. But you and I having a telephone conversation with you in London and me in New York, that's not going to work. You and I are going to have to live with that two-thirds of a second each time, not even counting the human reaction time.
No, we delay it, and we actually pop back and forth, so that way it looks like it's smooth.
Yeah, but you're fooling the public. You're taking out the delay times. The delay time is really there. In a live telephone conversation between you in London and me in New York, that that would not work is my first guess. Over to you on that one, Eric.
That's why we have delay devices and we have directors. They actually, when they do the communication, when he asks the guy in London a question, the guy in London answers back. The delay is actually twice as long as you think that it is, but because of the delay boxes, the TD, or the technical director, will take the appropriate source out of the previous delay box, where the guy will ask the question, but you won't see the guy asking the question until about 3 seconds after he's said it, or whatever the delay path is.
WS2N, Dick, have you heard of OneWeb satellite?
We'll go to you in a second, Paul. Eric, when it comes to broadcasting, you can do those tricks. When it comes to a live telephone conversation between you in London and me in New York, and we're really trying to pass, in other words, half the information you need is in my head, half the information I need is in your head, and we're trying to pass it back and forth with understanding, with questions and answers, it wouldn't work. You and I would have to live with roughly 1 second delay in each direction, and we'd be like ham radio transmissions. I would say a sentence, and then I would say over, and I'd wait a second and a half for you to answer me, so to speak, as far as my point of view is concerned. And at the end of your answer, you would say over. If we didn't do that, we're both talking on top of each other. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
We actually do that on a PL, but another time.
Okay, let me see if I have it. Yeah, you have a company, it's called OneWeb. It's going to be a satellite system that is going to manufacture 900 of these things and put it at 700 miles up instead of geosynchronous. So you're going to do away with your one-third satellites to be talking to the other satellites as they're coming overhead, and then a whole ground infrastructure is planned to be built. And the idea is to eliminate that geosynchronous system. SpaceX is already involved. They're going to be one of the big launches, along with Arian Space, of these satellites in the not too distant future, probably 5 or 10 years down the road. All KU type of stuff. Back to you, Dick.
We do that on XM Radio now.
The good news about a geosynchronous satellite at 22,300 miles up above the surface of the Earth is it covers almost a hemisphere of the Earth, so that a satellite properly placed can look at most of Europe and most of the United States simultaneously. That's the good news. The bad news is that long distance gives you a long time delay. That's a geo satellite. You've got LEOs, MEOs, and GEOs. LEO is low Earth, and it's low Earth orbit. MEO is medium Earth orbit. So if you chose medium Earth orbit, 10,000 miles up instead of 22,000, you have a lot less delay. That's the good news. The bad news, you see a much smaller chunk of the Earth simultaneously, very similar to geo-positioning satellites, and now you need a whole constellation of them. 24 satellites are required to run GPS. So yes, you could make a telephone-like system out of that, but it's another big investment in infrastructure to make those orbital satellites and to maintain all of them. So it's a great proposal. How soon do you think that system of MEOs is going to be fully operational, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
Yeah, they plan on going up 750 miles, around 900 satellites. In fact, the biggest problem is getting the FCC to agree with them that they're not going to interfere with the geosynchronous satellites that are up there. But once they can get that approved, they say they're ready to go. I mean, they're going to manufacture these things like automobiles, hundreds and hundreds of satellites coming off the factory floor. You know, they're going to be small, only a couple hundred pounds each. And they'll need 750, but the rest of the 900 will be backups. But they got plans on doing this. We'll see what happens. Probably 5 or 10 years down the road. Back to you, Dick.
The satellites themselves with mass production can be made somewhat inexpensive. The launching cost is not going to get inexpensive. It's a huge cost to launch all of those things. And when you got that many additional things in orbit around the Earth, the chances of now NORAD being able to keep track of all of that space junk and make sure that we're not colliding periodically with International Space Station and other manned operations, are they really going to get permission to put up 750 or 900 additional things and not worry about intercollisions and a much higher risk factor for human beings? I'm not so sure that this is quite the glamour fix. I wonder who's got an opinion on whether or not they're going to get approval to do all of this. K2RIW listening.
Comment.
Okay. Who just said comment? Was that George? Go ahead.
Thank you, Dick. KD2FIU. Of course, we understand that the propagation delay is not in the speed of the transmission. The propagation delay has to do with the reception, the encodement, and the transmission of the signal again. You can only do that so many times. The amount of distance, mileage, whatever it is not going to be the problem. The propagation delay is whether it's fiber to electronics to radio to radio to fiber to electronics to radio to satellite to satellite to satellite to radio to satellite to satellite to satellite. It's all going to be adding up. KD2FIU.
And so we owe to good evening.
Dick, OneWeb has a facility that they've already set up in Florida in the Enterprise Zone.
George, all of those latencies you described are because of the compression techniques. If you're willing to you're doing it in a more analog-like manner, each of those conversions can be done in microseconds instead of lots and lots of milliseconds. If you start doing a whole lot of compression, yes, you start building up a whole lot of latency. Back in the days when analog satellite television was being used, other than the only real delay was because of distance, the only other delay was fractions of microseconds through the electronics. Am I wrong on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
I'm sorry, Dick, I missed that. I stepped out for a second.
Back in the days when we had analog television and the satellites acting like a so-called bent pipe, your S-band and KU-band geosynchronous satellites transmitting video from, let's say, Europe to the United States, the only delay you had in that was due to the 22,000 miles of propagation delay. The real amount of time it took to go through the satellite, even though you're switching frequencies and switching modulation modes and whatever, as long as you're not using compression techniques, which have an awful lot of latency built in, if you're really doing it in a quasi-analog manner, there is no real delay other than fractions of a microsecond going through the electronics. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, the beauty of the satellites is that they're just heterodyne devices. They're essentially transmitters. They take one frequency and step it down or step it up. In fact, they step it down, mix it down, and out it goes. And the only real delay is just the path loss. Maybe there's fractions of a microsecond delay in terms of electronics, but nothing really to speak of.
I agree with you, Eric. When you go through a satellite in an analog-like manner, the only thing that creates any delay at all is the couple of inches of cable within the satellite. That's nothing. And the real delay is the group delay of your bandpass filter. That's going to give you some number of nanoseconds of delay, maybe as many as 30. So it's acting like 30 feet of cable. 30 feet of cable added to 22,000 miles of free space distance, the real delay is only distance. It's only when we start getting into these elaborate switching and compression techniques that are being used on our cell phones. Many of our cell phones have got a ridiculous ridiculous amount of latency because of the compression techniques. I've had cell phone conversations with people where you think you're going through a geosynchronous satellite because of the amount of delay.